On the 27th of March, the Coffee House Shots team will be joined by special guests to give you their take on a spring statement. We will be live on stage at London's Cadogan Hall. To get your tickets today, visit spectator.co.uk/springstatementlive. We'll see you there. Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Lara Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor. On this week's podcast, we ask, why is economic growth eluding labour? Does survival of the hottest explain why birds are so colourful? And what makes murders from the past so fascinating?
This new government has come in with a determination, a number one mission to grow the economy. That takes time.
This government is determined to turn around the poor performance of more than a decade when it comes to growth. And we need to go further and faster in growing our economy.
The way that I believe that you can reduce inequality, reduce poverty, and actually also improve the living standards of ordinary working people, not in poverty, but struggling to get by, is through growing the economy.
The growth numbers have come in higher than many expected, but I'm still not satisfied. You're not going to get growth without fighting for it.
That was just some of the many, many, many times the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has mentioned her central mission, which is growing Britain's economy. But why is economic growth proving so elusive for Labour? Our political editor, Katie Balls, and our new economics editor, Michael Simmons, asked this question in The Spectator's cover piece this week. And also in the magazine, George Osborne's former Chief of Staff, Rupert Harrison, analyses the problems facing the Chancellor. With a week to go before the Chancellor's spring statement, is Labour running out of options? I started by asking Michael just how big the challenge is for Rachel Reeves.
The Chancellor's got into this pickle because of essentially her fiscal rules, which she's made a cast iron or an ironclad commitment to stick to. And the main one of these is this rule that by the end of the OBR's, the Office for Budget Responsibility's, five-year forecast window, that debt would be falling as a share of national income. And this is where we get this term headroom, which is basically of all the tax measures, of all the tax receipts, of all the spending measures that were announced in autumn, she left herself with this £10 billion gap against those rules, and rising borrowing costs at the start of the year, and lackluster, well, non-existent growth, and growth forecasts that are almost certain to be downgraded, has wiped that out. So it's left the Chancellor with a choice, which is she somehow changes or ignores these rules, or she changes the sort of fiscal outlook of the country so that she recovers headroom against those rules.
Well, how would you change the fiscal outlook there?
Well, I should say this is something that, although it's been called for by people like such as Andy Haldane, the former chief economist from the Bank of England, I think it's something that is something the Chancellor's team suggests, you know, she's not going to do, that we have no idea how the markets would react to a move like that. But effectively, you would make the, if you were going to do it, you could go back to the sort of pre-2010 days where we just didn't have spending restraints like that, and you can say, I'm going to borrow my way out of this problem, and debt is not going to be falling in 5 years' time, but that is no longer a rule that I'm going to be bound by. But that's something that, to be clear, I don't think is going to happen.
So what do you think is going to happen?
So she's going to set out various reforms to the NHS, to the civil service, to which she thinks will make the country more productive, and she hopes that will feed through to growth forecasts. In terms of immediately meeting those rules, we have this concept of like the spending envelope, which is basically over the 5 years that the OBR measure things for, or they forecast for, that you sort of backload cuts, or you have growth in spending that's below inflation, so real cuts in real terms. Those will be made slightly more extreme. Non-protected government departments have been asked to find, you know, quite big cuts. They've been asked to find the 20% least important or least crucial spending. So at the towards the back of the forecast, she'll make cuts to try and meet those rules, which is partly why I think some of the benefits reforms that were announced by Liz Kendall, the Work and Pension Secretary yesterday, actually don't come in a few years, because I think it's very sort of OBR-driven policymaking with the end of this forecast period in mind.
Rupert, in your piece for the magazine this week, you start by taking issue, I suppose, with the Chancellor calling next week's event a spring statement or even a spring forecast. It is not that, you say. It is a, what it really is an emergency budget. And that's actually what we also say on the cover of the magazine this week. It's Labour's emergency budget. Is this a humiliation then for the Chancellor?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the Treasury are doing a good job of saying this is business as usual. And of course, you know, the world has changed post-Trump. We should be focusing on government efficiencies and defence. But, you know, let's be clear, this is pretty unprecedented that less than 6 months after a kind of once in a parliament budget that was meant to be, you know, the big tax rises, set the fiscal envelope, set the strategy for the whole parliament. Less than 6 months later, she has had to come back and cut her spending envelope, scrabble together some pretty last minute cuts to the welfare budget. And I totally agree that all of this policymaking is being driven by kind of meeting those OBR numbers. And all of that is because she took a huge gamble back in October. So when she put together that first budget, she raised taxes by 40 billion. She added another 30 billion annually to borrowing for investment. And she only left herself £10 billion of headroom against her fiscal rules. Now, £10 billion sounds like a lot of money, but when you compare that to the volatility in the economy and the public finances over a five-year period, it's absolutely tiny. And almost every commentator at the time said this is, you know, she's cutting it very fine. She's not giving herself much wiggle room. It was a huge gamble. It hasn't paid off. And so she's now got to sort of scrabble together an emergency budget in the middle of a spending review. I don't think this has ever happened, certainly not in knowledge of sort of British fiscal history, as a government had to suddenly change the envelope in the middle of a spending review.
Mm. And something which you and Katie and Michael seem to agree on in your pieces is that without radical reform of the public sector, growth seems quite unlikely. Do you think Labour is capable of making such reforms to the public sector? And if not, what options for growth are left to them?
Well, look, there are some cold realities here, which is that growth in the short term has definitely been hit by their decision to raise employer national insurance and by some of the prospects of some of the other things like labour market regulations. Growth over the longer term, 5 to 10 years, is just very, very hard to shift. There's a lot of things that they need to get right to even make a small dent in that. So they need to really go radical on the planning reforms. They need to sort out the energy market. And crucially, they need to sort out the productivity collapse in parts of the public sector. Those are all very, very hard things to move the dial on. I think that they have begun to show some serious signs of intent on policy. I think they are sort of taking some decisions like abolishing NHS England. It remains to be seen how radical the planning reforms will be. Some of these reforms to regulation and planning could be impactful. But the reality is that, you know, I think they really came into office thinking that a Labour government would make all this better. They genuinely thought they could move the dial on growth and that that would lead to money flowing into the government coffers that they could then spend on a sort of generous spending settlement and get re-elected that way. The reality is it's much, much harder than it sounds. And I think that she's now in a situation where nobody believes the spending profile she has set out. She's given, because she's constrained, she set out these very generous increases in public spending, particularly for the NHS in the first couple of years. And then after this week is going to be an even tighter settlement towards the end of the period, probably just as tight as it was back in sort of some of the tightest Conservative spending plans in terms of year-on-year growth. And nobody believes that in Whitehall. Nobody believes that in the markets. Everybody knows that she's going to have to come back for more at some point. And this is a huge problem for her. It may come in the autumn. She may be forced to do it by the economic figures and the borrowing forecasts in the autumn, in which case the only thing left to her is going to be tax. That's hugely problematic given that they ruled out at the election raising most of these taxes. I think she really needs to get ahead of the curve. Like I say in the piece, she needs to stop gambling with these sort of tiny amounts of headroom. She can see this problem coming down the track. First best would be really radical reform to the welfare system and the public sector to improve productivity. But if that's not going to happen, it's a Labour government. She knows that her fellow cabinet members are going to want a lot more spending. She needs to get ahead of the curve. She should do something on tax now bite the bullet and give herself proper wriggle room. Now, that would be a Labour economic strategy. It wouldn't be what I would recommend. But if you're a Labour chancellor, you need to deliver for a Labour government. She needs to get ahead of the curve now. Otherwise, she's going to be just stumbling from fiscal event to fiscal event, dealing with the crisis as it comes.
Michael, something which struck me from your piece with Katie is just how bad Britain's public sector productivity is at the moment. I wondered if you could paint that picture a little bit for our listeners.
Yeah, so I mean, over the past few years, the state has grown. The number of people working in the civil service, working in the NHS, has grown. And the sort of striking stat that we pull out for the piece is sort of, so since the first 3 months of 2020, the sort of inputs into the economy from the state have grown. And by that, I mean people working in the public sector, resources in the public sector, etc. They've grown by 20%. And you might say, okay, well, if the outputs, so the contribution to GDP from that was the same, then maybe that was fine. But in fact, they've only grown by 12%. So there's this gap. And we reckon that essentially, that if productivity growth had continued on the still albeit lackluster path it was on before the pandemic, then the state would be able to deliver the same level of services that it does now, but for 40 billion a year less, which is a huge amount, really, is, you know, four times the headroom from autumn that we're quibbling over.
Rupert, in terms of the Tories, should they be worried about some of the noises being made from the Labour camp at the moment? So things such as you mentioned, abolishing NHS England or cutting overseas aid in order to fund defence. Those are policy measures which I imagine are pretty popular with a lot of Conservative voters. Do you think that Labour outflanking the Tories here on some of their decisions when it comes to spending?
I mean, I think that they won't end up doing that. I mean, the irony, of course, is that NHS England was a Conservative creation, although I think most Conservatives would now regard it as having been a mistake. I think, look, when you're in opposition, you have to... Your long-term game is building back credibility and trust with the public. And therefore, you have to back things. When the government does things that are in line with your instincts, in line with your analysis, you have to back them. And then you focus your fire on where you're thinking where you think they're making a mistake. I think that there is still going to be plenty for the Conservatives to focus on when it comes to, you know, I just think at PMQs and elsewhere, they should just be going again and again on the employer next rise, the impact that's having on the economy, on small businesses. Like there are some, you know, they've got a wide open target, I think, albeit they still need to earn back trust on the issue on things like immigration. So there's still a lot for the Conservatives to focus on. But look, to be credible, I think a really good example is going to be these welfare reforms. I think these welfare reforms have been put together in a rush. I think the reforms to PIP look a little bit arbitrary and are going to be very controversial. But to be a credible Conservative opposition, you've got to, you know, vote for reforms like this, back the government when you think it's moving in the right direction. Otherwise, you know, you just start to lose all credibility.
So actually on those reforms towards PIP, which Rupert just mentioned, Michael, when it comes to welfare, which again features in your piece, what do you make of the announcements by Liz Kendall this week to try and reduce the bill by 5 billion? How much of a impact do you think that will have?
Well, I mean, firstly, we should say we don't actually know it's going to be 5 billion. That they've not released sort of a costing on this. They've just said this is their expectation and wait to see what the OBR says next week. But I think if you look at the forecast that we have on our Spectator Data Hub from the DWP, the sickness spend by the time a lot of these changes come in was due to rise by, I think it was 15 billion. So even if you take off 5, it's still going up by 10. You're still going to see nearly a million more people claiming these benefits. So I think to say, you know, what I started off the podcast with, I think a lot of it seems about pleasing the sort of bean counters in the OBR rather than genuine welfare reform. What I would say, one exception to that is some point that, you know, Spectator writers have been hammering on for a while, is about the rise of young people. They get stuck in unfit to work category and then never go on to seek jobs and seek employment. And I think the change that they're going to remove eligibility for the health elements of UC until you're 22, so that you will still be in this category where you're encouraged to seek work, I think that is a genuine reform and a positive one.
Michael, are you quite against the OBR? You called them bean counters just then, and I got the impression from your piece you're not entirely a fan.
I should apologise for calling them bean counters. They are produced you know, excellently detailed stuff. And I think on the whole, we are much better off than we were in the pre-2010 era when there was no OBR and the Chancellor could just, as someone said the other day, fiddle the growth figures to get them out whatever hole they are in. So I think that is a good thing. But it's worth saying there are voices, you know, not just on the left, who would say that we've become, you know, too fiscally strict by following these rules. It's not a view I think I personally hold, but it's I try to reflect in the piece that it's a kind of open debate. That said, I think a lot of this is down to what the market will wear. I mean, we saw with Truss's mini budget that if you try to deviate too much from this kind of accepted view that actually, no, the days of borrowing our way out of problems should be behind us, the markets are not going to wear it.
Rupert, just finally then, I'd like to get your view, given that there is a lot of criticism these days of the OBR, that perhaps it's too strict or it creates short-term policy making. Do you think such criticisms have warrant?
No, I don't, because I think ultimately it's the politicians who create the short-term thinking. You know, the OBR is just there to reflect, you know, a best independent guess of reality. And the reality is, as you were just saying, that we face genuine fiscal constraints. We've got 100% debt as a share of GDP. The markets are close to the limit of what they're willing to tolerate. And the OBR are just presenting the reality. And what I see the OBR, I mean, look, I would say this, I helped to create it in 2010. But, you know, if you go back to before 2010, it was a ridiculous and internationally ridiculous system whereby the Chancellor could make their own forecasts. And Gordon Brown, Alistair Darling, you know, were ridiculed again and again for tweaking the forecasts, making them unrealistic as a way of trying to massage the figures. It was not a good way to do business. You need to have some independent validation there. They're just presenting the politicians with reality. And it's quite interesting to see that, you know, when the OBR was presenting Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng with reality, it was you know, quite unpopular on the right of the Conservative Party because people didn't want to hear that reality. And now that the OBR is presenting reality to a Labour government, it's becoming unpopular on the left of the Labour government because they don't want to hear reality either. You know, the Office of Budget Responsibility, they're really just the Office of Reality. They're forcing politicians to confront the truth and the facts. And politicians hate doing that. And, you know, the OBR can be flexible and innovative. So when, for example, in 2012, when we cut the top rate of tax from 50 to 45, and actually George Osborne wanted to go further to 40. But when we did that, the static costing of that was many, many billions. But we presented good evidence that actually, because of the behavioral effects, the costing would be much closer to zero. The OBR accepted that evidence and costed it at less than 100 million. So, you know, if you present good evidence for your reforms, this is just an organization of, you know, technocrats who say, yep, okay, there's the evidence. We'll put that in the forecast. It's for the politicians to confront reality.
Rupert and Michael, thank you both very much indeed for joining me. Laura, what else do you enjoy in the magazine this week?
I'm going to go for Angus Colwell's notes on dripping. Angus writes about the debate that rages online between whether seed oils or animal fats are better for you. He has visited various places to investigate this, and I think we can hear an extract from his notes on here.
You don't hear all that much here about beef dripping, as tallow is known, unless you happen to be in Newcastle or Yorkshire. It fell out of fashion for a few reasons. Industrial seed oils were cheaper, more people became vegetarian, and BSE didn't help beef fat's reputation either. We also started to kid ourselves that we could make deep-fried food somehow healthier if the oil contained fewer calories. The risk now is that RFK's endorsement of dripping threatens to make the issue partisan. Are you a beef fat boy or a seed oil boy? But let's put politics aside and focus on the most important matter when it comes to food. Taste. The vital point is that food fried in beef dripping tastes better. I visited Marlow Fish Bar in South London for research, which is one of a handful of London chippies that still uses dripping. The whole shop is filled with the amazing honk of beef fat, and I was delighted to discover that it serves one of the best fish and chips I've had. Was the taste of beef dripping making me more virile, more manly? I like to think so.
Next up, is sexual selection responsible for some of nature's most colourful oddities? In the magazine this week, Matt Ridley writes about the concept of sexual selection, that evolution is not just driven by survival of the fittest, but also through seduction by the hottest. This was a conclusion that Charles Darwin eventually drew, but one which caused a rift amongst his peers and the early proponents of evolutionary theory. With their colourful crests, tails, ruffs and plumes, and their penchant for seduction through singing, birds provide the boldest examples of sexual selection, writes Matt, who outlines this further in his new book, Birds, Sex and Beauty. Why has evolution's fun side been so overlooked, he asks. Matt joined the podcast alongside David Putz, Professor of Anthropology and Psychology at Penn State University. I started by asking Matt about the background to the theory of sexual selection.
So Darwin thought sexual selection was really quite different from natural selection. Most other scientists at the time and later said, no, they're just part of the same thing. They're all part of survival of the fittest. But what Darwin was pointing out was that there's an awful lot of beauty, particularly in the world of birds, which is hard to explain as an aid to survival, but possibly easier to explain as an aid to seduction. And so maybe being able to attract a mate, even at the cost of survival, had different outcomes than being able to survive.
And why was that particularly controversial, even among Darwin's allies, as you say, in the piece?
Yeah, what's so striking to me is that he won the battle for natural selection very quickly. Most scientists, most biologists of the day, at least, agreed with him, thought he had a tremendous insight. But he minded just as much about sexual selection. He spent a whole book writing about it, The Descent of Man. And almost none of his colleagues and friends seemed to have agreed with him. Alfred Russel Wallace, the co-discoverer of natural selection, parted from him really quite dramatically on this topic. So did Thomas Henry Huxley and Herbert Spencer, you know, his usual allies. None of them thought that females choosing gaudy males was a significant factor in evolution of things like peacock's tails. They were kind of embarrassed by this theory. And they did have one good point, which is that he couldn't explain why females would prefer gaudy males. And that had to wait till the next century.
David, Matt implies in his piece that it's possible that human evolution could have followed a similar process. What do you make of that theory?
I think that sexual selection has been pretty important in human evolution. And there are lots of lines of evidence for that, including one of the things that sexual selection tends to do is create sex differences. And humans are fairly highly sexually differentiated species in terms of body size, especially muscle mass, and things like voice pitch, which is, you know, we're the most sexually differentiated great ape in terms of voice pitch. Males have much lower, about half the fundamental frequency, and facial hair and lots of other characteristics that female body fat distribution is unique in humans compared to other primates. That looks like a, you know, sexually selected trait as well. One distinction that I would make between humans and really most mammals and birds is that, you know, there are different sort of what are called mechanisms of sexual selection. That is, sexual selection is the kind of selection that favors traits to win mating opportunities. In other words, the trait increases reproductive success, but it does that by winning mates. And there are multiple sort of modes of sexual selection or mechanisms of sexual selection. One of those is mate choice, but there's also, there are others like contest competition, which is the use of force or threat of force to exclude same-sex competitors from mating opportunities. And that seems to have been more important over human evolution. And also, you know, all of our closest living relatives like chimps, gorillas, orangutans, you see, you know, large aggressive males with weapons. And it really looks like contest competition was more important in shaping their traits than mate choice was. But mate choice was almost certainly an important selection pressure in humans too.
Yeah. And just to add to that, I sometimes wish I was a bird, because birds are much more beautiful. They're much more colorful. They're much more tuneful than most mammals. Mammals grunt or roar or shriek. They very rarely sing. We do occasionally sing, but other mammals rarely do. And we're brown. You know, we're nearly all brown, all mammals, occasionally gray or black or something like that. But birds are blue and red and yellow and orange, and they have tufts and crests and ruffs and long tails, and they sing ridiculous songs, you know, which is arguably, and this I think does, I'm being flippant, but I'm also being serious, because it reinforces David's point that on the whole, in mammals, sexual selection takes the form of competition among the males to corral, dominate, and control access to females. Whereas in birds, it takes the form of competition among the males to persuade females to mate with you. And you see this very clearly in birds like the black grouse, which is the one I spend a lot of time looking at, because the females wander through this group of displaying males completely unmolested. And when I took a primatologist to see the lek, she was amazed. She said, "That's bizarre. If this was mammals, you know, there'd be chaos." So, birds are better, basically. Sorry.
Matt, are there any scientists who still argue today that these colourful ornaments that you find, particularly among birds, that these are actually indicators of health and therefore strength rather than mate choice? Are there still people who deny this element of evolutionary theory championed by Darwin?
Well, to be clear, that is sort of what Wallace thought mate choice was all about. And yes, that is the view that most evolutionary biologists still cling to, and my view too strongly. I think they're not entirely wrong. I think, you know, there is clearly an element of being able to select males with the best immune systems, disease resistance, general fitness, strength, good nutritional qualities, and so on. And that's something you want to pass on to your kids. But the problem with that as an explanation for most bird coloration is that it would probably end up giving you one way or a few ways of showing that males were healthy. I mean, yeah, making them big. You know, the big, strong male is probably the healthiest one. And yet that's not what we see. What we see is completely different exaggerations in different species. And it's sort of random. There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason as to which part of the body gets exaggerated, whether it's the wings or the tail or the crest or the breast, whether it's blue or red or black or orange or whatever it might be. And that very arbitrary nature of it, for me, points to the subtler point that what the females want from the male is a form of fitness for their offspring, but the fitness they're after is the ability to attract mates. It's a sort of circular argument.
David, one of the points that Matt makes in his piece is that within humans, certain things that are prized, such as wit or eloquence or intelligence, make relatively little sense as survival aids, but could potentially have social benefits and perhaps even sexual benefits too. What do you make of that theory?
Yeah, that's a great question. So evolutionary biologists break up the sort of consequences of mate choice into what are called direct benefits that are things like resources, status, parental care, things like that, that would benefit the female or her offspring directly versus what they sometimes call indirect benefits, which are genes that offspring could inherit. So you could, you know, a female peahen could prefer a peacock because he has high quality genes that he can pass on to offspring. And both of those potential benefits have been linked to some of the things that humans prefer. I mean, you could imagine preferring an intelligent mate because intelligence is highly heritable and you're going to pass on genes for intelligence to your offspring, but also an intelligent mate is one who is likely to have higher social status, ability to acquire resources higher status in the community and things like that. So, I think the evidence for humans is that there are both direct and indirect benefits of mate choice, but I'll agree with Matt that the efforts that many evolutionary biologists, including evolutionary anthropologists and evolutionary psychologists, to try to figure out whether human sexually selected traits indicate heritable immune function, which is one of the major hypotheses. The evidence isn't great there. That there's a strong body of theory and literature in evolutionary biology that is what these ornaments are actually advertising, is genes to make your offspring healthier. And the evidence there is fairly equivocal.
But what I found very interesting, Matt, from your piece was that, as you say, because it's circular in some way, some of these indicators are completely arbitrary because they almost take on a significance of their own. Am I getting that right?
Yes. And Darwin said that the purpose of bride ornaments is to charm the female and for no other purpose. And I think what he was getting at, and you sort of see this when you watch birds displaying to members of the opposite sex, is that for whatever reason, a long tail or a tail with lots of eyes painted on it like a peacock or large wings in an Argus pheasant is the thing that species finds sexy. Now, why should that be? And the answer that Ronald Fisher gave in 1930 and Russell Landy and Mark Kirkpatrick kind of confirmed in 1980 with some very elegant mathematical modeling is that you might want, as a female, to make sure that you are mating with the kind of male that other females want to mate with, because then your sons have a better chance of attracting mates. So that kind of selection could go in any direction. It could be completely arbitrary. It could be, you know, that you're supposed to be red in the front and blue in the back, or blue in the front and red in the back. And so that's the attraction. One of the things I try and get across in my book and in this article is that we sometimes look too hard for rhyme and reason, for logic behind the way animals are colored. And this theory gives you a theory as to say, just like fashion, it can go in any direction, in any season, and it can, there's no point in trying to say, oh, the reason, you know, skirts are longer this year than last year is because the weather's worse or something. You know, it rarely makes sense to do that. And I think it's the same in the bird world.
Matt and David, thank you very much for joining.
Thank you. And finally, why are we so fascinated by historical murders? Hallie Rubenhold's new book, Story of a Murder, The Wives, The Mistress, and Dr. Cribben, is the lead book review this week in the magazine. Lisa Hilton, who reviews the book, writes that it is an intellectual adventure which retells the Dr. Cribben murder case from the perspective of the women involved. But why do these extreme cases continue to capture our imaginations? What makes learning about women, whether victims or accomplices, so compelling? Hallie joined the podcast alongside the historian and broadcaster Alice Loxton. I started by asking Hallie to outline what happened with Dr. Cribben for listeners who may not be aware of the case.
I sort of balk at these sorts of requests, because in the entire time I've been writing this book, I've really struggled with an elevator pitch, because the story is epic. I mean, it's massive. And one of the problems is it's always been told as a very linear murder story with a focus on the killer and what he was doing, what he was thinking. But actually, its cast is so broad and so varied, and there are so many subplots and so many fascinating things going on, that it's really hard to just capture, you know, in two sentences what this book is actually about. I mean, it was in 1910, this murder, the Cribben murder, was called the crime of the century. To give you an idea of how insane the publicity and the chat was around this, I mean, at the trial, at Crippen's trial, and he was eventually caught, that you had to get tickets to go into the Old Bailey. There were crowds gathering outside. And during the hearing at Bow Street Magistrates Court, people were actually climbing on the roof to peer in through the skylights. So this was an absolutely sensational crime. Dr. Cribben murdered his wife, Belle Elmore, who was a music hall performer. They were American. And he ran off with his mistress, Ethel Leneve, dressed as father and son, and tried to escape to Canada. But they were caught by Inspector Dew of Scotland Yard, because the ship's captain had notified Scotland Yard that by Marconi wireless, which was wireless telegraphy, which is a completely new invention, that he had the murderer and the two fugitives on board. And so this was spectacular, and the whole world was watching, and they were, you know, reading the papers twice a day and following the story, and Cribben had no idea that they were onto him. And so that's why this became so sensational. But my book, actually, that is the most sensational part. But there is so much more to this story. There's no point in telling the story in this kind of straight, linear way, which is just focused on the murderer. There's so much more going on in the story.
And so your book, it focuses on the women in the story, isn't that right?
Yes. It's told really through their perspectives. And in telling the story through the women's perspectives, we really broaden out the narrative. And we have a much bigger panoramic view of the turn of the century in the transatlantic world and what was going on, you know, as motor cars and wireless telegraphy and super fast ocean liners and motion picture and all of this stuff were, you know, kind of appearing on the scene and how quickly the world was changing. And there was a kind of revolution going on, especially in women's lives and in people's lives. And, you know, we tend to think of this, women's experiences at this time is just being framed by suffrage, and suffrage is one slice of the pie, and suffrage doesn't feature in this book at all. You know, this is a story about women at the turn of the century, you know, which isn't about suffrage. And there's so much to say.
Alice, last month you reviewed Thou Savage Woman by Blessin' Adams for The Spectator. That book looks at female murderers rather than female victims. Why do you think there is such a particular fascination with female killers?
Well, it's obviously within this true crime genre, which we're totally obsessed with across time and across the world. I mean, you look at the work of Agatha Christie and she is the best-selling author, I think, after Shakespeare. And so there is something about the human psyche that makes us totally obsessed with these stories. And that is the case now with modern readers, but it's also the case throughout history. And Blessin' Adams writes this amazing book, which is all about looking at how... Yes, there have been these female murderers, but how people in the past have not only obsessed with them in the way that we're obsessed with murder in a general way, but we perceive women as murderers in quite a different way. And it's all about how women are perceived to be more passive, how they are perceived to be carers, and it's all of these traditional stereotypes of women that makes it so shocking to our ancestors. And so it's all about the sensationalist drama that arose, you know, the pamphlets, the stories that emerged from these events. And it's a wonderful book.
Hallie, just picking up on what Alice said there about historically women who are murderers have been perceived in a very particular way in contrast to the perception of male murderers. Do you think the same is true of victims, of murder victims?
Well, I mean, women make the sort of classic victim because women are supposed to be passive, and therefore, you know, women are seen as the kind of natural targets, and, you know, and perhaps people have more sympathy for that because there's a greater expectation that women will be targeted. But I would like to add to that that there is a female murderer in Story of a Murder as well, and that is Ethel and Eve. And part of what I did in this book was quite often the victim, Belle Elmore, has been demonized for, just demonized in general as having, you know, solicited and warranted this murder. And Ethel has been always seen as this kind of passive accomplice who is manipulated by this older, powerful man. And my book really turns both of those assumptions on their head. And Ethel was absolutely involved in this murder. Although she was acquitted, there was no attempt to actually explore her role in the murder because the DPP wanted Crippen. They wanted to make sure they got him. And so, you know, this is, you know, two sides of the same coin about how justice views women both as victims and perpetrators.
It sounds from the review as though the barrister defending Leneuve almost sort of played up to those stereotypes of what women are meant to be, because I think I'm right in saying that she was presented as being kind of very feminine and innocent. So is that sort of part of the story, that she was sort of able to get away with stuff because of those stereotypes?
Yes, very much so. Yes. I mean, Ethel leaned into this idea of being passive, of being a kind of wallflower, you know, a quiet woman who stared at her shoes when people spoke to her. And that was not Ethel at all. And that is borne out in what other people say about her, in her behavior, and what she actually says about herself after the trial. She was an incredibly scheming and calculating woman. And I would say even psychopathic.
How do you go about when you're writing books such as this one, and also your acclaimed book, The Five, which told the stories of five female victims of Jack the Ripper? How do you approach it ethically, I suppose? Because there's a lot that's written now about the way in which true crime, even historic true crime from a century ago, how that is approached in a way that doesn't feel lurid, I suppose, or kind of nasty. There's a lot that's written about this, a lot that's critiqued about this. And I wonder how you go about approaching it in your own research and writing.
It's a real problem, historical true crime, I feel, because what's happened is that it has leapt straight from the front pages of a newspaper, and whether that was in 1888 or 1910, and straight into, you know, books. And from those books, you know, people then write histories of what happened based on hearsay and based, I mean, there's no filter. There's nobody fact-checking. There has been nobody fact-checking. So you, what you just get are regurgitations of hearsay or something that they think makes a good story. And wrapped into that is all sorts of prejudice and bigotry from the era and stuff that's completely obsolete today that we don't subscribe to at all. You know, and so I think it's, you know, we really have to, as historians, and this really is a call to arms to all historians and to everybody in general, you know, really think twice before just repeating the stories you hear about a really good murder story that happened 100 or 200 years ago, because chances are what you're repeating is completely untrue. And so I investigate murders as historical events, and I look for the documentation, and I look for what else has been going on in society at that time. And, you know, exploring it as a historian, not as somebody who just wants to tell a really good lurid tale.
And just finally, do you think in the future historians will look at contemporary murder trials from today in the same way, or do you think the sort of rise of social media and our kind of mass reporting on these things will have changed it, and it won't perhaps be as interesting?
Yeah, my heart goes out to historians of the future looking at today's events, because, you know, when we look at events from, say, the 1600s, there are a few sources, if any, and that can make it very difficult, but it can also, I suppose, focus the mind. And I expect that if you are looking at a murder trial from modern age in, say, 200 years' time, you will never, ever, ever be able to look at all the sources, because you just won't be able to you know, every single person will be talking about it. You know, every text that's sent, you'll just never be able to look at it all. So I think it'll be much harder, to be honest. But maybe we'll, you know, lots and more histories will be rewritten all the time, because there's just so much information to get through.
I would agree. Alice has said exactly what I would have said. I mean, I do pity the historians of the future, because, you know, we have created so much stuff. You know, how do you begin to sift through all of this? You know, it's going to prove to be a real challenge.
And it's a bit like in, you know, you look at the Second World War and you look at 20th century history, there are so many histories being written about that all the time. The Second World War, there's a new history that's literally never been written. And that's, you know, that's a kind of partially modern age thing. And so I think 70 years later, it's only going to be 10 times the amount of material to look through.
Alice and Hallie, thank you very much for joining. And that's everything this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed the discussion, please do pick up a copy of the magazine to read all of the articles in full and many more. And if you do enjoy the podcast, please click the follow button. You'll then be notified when a new episode is out. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm William Moore. And we hope you'll join us again next week.